crisis of liberal democracy that those who advocate the post-truth notion think of is very different from the real crisis of democracy, as you pointed out, which
these metaphors and these discourses, they shape not only how we understand a problem, but also how we try to solve it.
Hello and welcome to Between the Bubbles, your place for independent and critical takes on topics at the nexus of science, society, politics, and economics. I'm your host, Ninad Bondre. Thanks for joining me. My guest today is Johan Farkas, who's a doctoral student at Malmö University in southern Sweden. His research lies at the intersection of digital media, journalism, and democracy. I came across Johan's work some years ago when I was searching for critical scholarly work on the notion of post-truth. And his book, along with Yannick Skou, caught my attention at the time. I reviewed it for the Svenska Dagbladet, which is a Swedish daily, published an article there. And subsequently, I also referred to it in my article in the Philosophical Salon. I feel the book's a really impressive achievement, and I'm very glad to welcome him for a conversation here on various facets of post-truth. So welcome, Johan.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So let's dig into the questions right away, because your book's super interesting, and I also felt that your understanding of democracy is in some ways far more sophisticated than many intellectuals who were bemoaning the passing of the truth era and who seem to hold a rather sort of standard, if I may say so, picture of democracy. And so I can start by asking you about this period around late 2016 or early 2017. When there was a sudden influx of articles and voices in mainstream media and perhaps some academic journals that were proclaiming and lamenting our entry into a post-truth era or age. As a media and communication studies scholar yourself, I was wondering what your initial thoughts were about this notion and phenomenon when it burst onto the scene.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. It's definitely been some explosive years in terms of this debate and how it's been developing. So if we go back to 2016, really exploded with the Brexit elections and then of course the election of Donald Trump. I was at the IT University of Copenhagen at that point, and I was just getting into research, just finishing my master's degree, and wanted to get further into research. And I was working on social media and disinformation, being interested in also reading older theories of propaganda and mass media and trying to understand what was happening on social media with some of these older theories that really intrigued me, because what I could see and my colleagues could see was that while these platforms enabled new forms of disinformation, new forms of fake profiles and so forth, many of the strategies behind were very old, right? These propaganda strategies were kind of the same in some ways. And I think we've continued to see that going forward. And then it was quite baffling to me when it suddenly, there was this explosion of debate around fake news, post-truth, because for one thing, it was really presented as something that was only new, right? Social media was suddenly causing these completely new effects that were detrimental to democracy, which I was skeptical towards from the onset, because I had just been reading all this propaganda theory or going all the way to the 1940s that showed me that while, again, the technologies are new, the platforms were new, many of these things we were seeing going on social media had these long historical trajectories or roots.
Yeah.
At the same time, of course, this notion of post-truth also really sparked my interest and in some ways also worry, because, again, there was this very ahistorical sense to it, right? That suddenly we are post-truth, which of course posed the question of when exactly was this truth era, right? It kind of had this implied ideal of some kind of magical time where everything was great, right? Which was interesting because this term post-truth really rose to prominence the same year Donald Trump was traveling around talking about making America great again, right?
So we had
two different narratives, but both were kind of claiming that we had to go back to some mythical era. So I kind of shifted my attention, especially with my colleague Yannick Skov, from studying disinformation on social media, which I've continued to do, but increasingly my research has then focused on studying how we discuss fake news and post-truth, and what are the political implications of the way we imagine society being in a post-truth era, in a crisis of fake news. So that has increasingly been my focus now during my PhD studies and also in this book we published. I mean, when people hear the title Post-Truth, Fake News and Democracy, it might sound like what we are doing is yet again, I mean, as all the other books saying that we live in a post-truth era and this is horrible. What we instead tried to do with this book was to take a step back, so to say, and ask these critical questions about how is post-truth being portrayed? What is being blamed for post-truth? But also, what are the problems with the way in which we talk about it and the way in which we imagine society being in a crisis?
You have in some ways also answered my follow-up question, which would have been about what motivated you to write the book. But this was excellent, and I really agree with you. I mean, you are really preaching to the choir here, because I lived in the United States in the lead up to the Iraq War, and then I was able to witness all the official lies and propaganda at firsthand. And I was really surprised, taken aback to witness the emergence of this post-truth narrative. And one of my interviewees, Catherine Brown, has mentioned, you know, how post-truth revived old dichotomies like objective versus subjective or facts versus values and so on. And I entirely agreed with her. And as you said now, you know, I just could not buy the implicit assumption of some sort of a truth era that had preceded the world created by Brexit and Donald Trump's election. But in your book, actually, you challenged another, which I think is an even more foundational assumption, which is that the survival and functioning of democracy depends on truth. And I think this is an argument that I actually hadn't seen, because I was scouting a lot for various types of critical material on post-truth. So that really intrigued me. So could you expand on that argument for the benefit of any listeners who might not have read your book?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so again, by taking a step back in our book and in my work in general, I've tried to discuss and reflect on both, again, the historical roots of this post-truth narrative, but also, again, the historical roots of truth and democracy, right? So I think what has been problematic about the post-truth narrative, again, is that so often we hear this very prominent discourse that society is in a state of crisis. This crisis is caused by a demise of truth. And to save democracy, to save our societies, we need to put truth center again. And we need to do so through radical means. We need to do so by any means necessary in some ways. And also take, like kind of, we legitimize taking actions that we would not have found legitimate a few years ago. I mean, which we have seen across the world, censorship laws, new forms of government agencies that can impose restrictions on journalism and so forth. So all this has kind of become legitimized. But what we question in our book is, or step back and say, is that we need to remember that democracy is not first and foremost about truth. Democracy is first and foremost about letting the people who are affected by politics also have a say in politics, right? And they need to have a say in politics, not because they always know everything or always know best, but because they are the ones who feel the material implications of politics.
Absolutely.
Like, people elect someone not because they know that this person, they can't see the future, no one can, they don't know that this person will do best, but they elect someone in the faith that they will do what they want for democracy, want for society. And if that doesn't happen, then there is a new election in 4 years, hopefully we can vote in someone new. Like, that's the basis of liberal democracy.
Yeah.
And of course, ideally, democracy extends beyond just the election every 4 years. That also means that people have influence in their workplace, have influence in different aspects of their lives, right? What critical scholars, I mean, such as Wolfgang Streck or Chantal Mouffe or Colin Crouch, all of whom we draw on heavily in our book, these critical scholars have argued for decades that democracy is in a state of crisis, but that the crisis is about the decline of participation, the decline of feeling that you have a say in politics, a decline of feeling that there is a difference between the center left and center right. And I think when we look at the numbers, this is what we see. Like, voter participation has been declining across the world for the past decades. And we just now had the French election, which had the lowest voter turnout ever. And this can't just be explained by social media or misinformation. It is something much broader. It is about people no longer feeling that there is a difference and that they are involved in the political system. And so what we argue in our book is that this is, in fact, the real crisis that we need to address. And the problem with the post-truth narrative is that many of the solutions being presented to post-truth, they are actually potentially making things worse by reducing how people can express themselves, excluding people from participating in democracy.
I couldn't agree more, and you raised many themes here, which I will come to in other questions. But something that you said, you know, has been echoed in different ways by other people I'm interviewing. For example, Catherine Happer, who's also a media scholar, but more a sociologist of media, one could say. And she's also talked about the decline in trust generally related to neoliberalism in the UK in the run up to Brexit. So there's a common clutch of critical scholars who are sort of reaching that conclusion from various angles. And it seems like the crisis of liberal democracy that those who advocate the post-truth notion think of is very different from the real crisis of democracy, as you pointed out, which has to do with this declining participation and so on. And so I think it was fantastic that you really sort of challenged that assumption of the link between democracy and truth. But I then wanted to come to, you know, you've talked about various villains and victims, and sometimes the same entity has been called a villain and victim when sort of bringing up the causes of post-truth. And you noted in the book that journalism has emerged as a victim and villain. The discourses surrounding post-truth do assume a tight coupling between journalism, truth, and democracy. And you rightly problematize this coupling, questioning the notion that strengthening traditional journalism would serve as an antidote to the supposed malady of post-truth. But this prompts a few questions in my mind, and these are complex questions. You know, I can just put them to you, and we can see where it goes. The first is, you know, journalism still is an important institution in the world as it is today. And I was wondering what you think is the proper role for journalism. You know, we live in liberal democracies here in the West and in some other parts of the world. And what could journalism do, or which would be an appropriate role for it in the world as it is today? And then secondly, you know, you also talk about this expanded and deepened democracy along the lines of proposals by Chantal Mouffe and others that you've referred to in the book. And so if we move towards that sort of a world, which role would journalism serve in that one then? Would it, for example, be the platform through which societal conflicts are brought to light, or are allowed to play out in a participative manner. So this is a lot to pack in, but I thought I would just throw it out there, and then, you know, feel free to take whichever direction suits you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Definitely big questions, but also super important ones. So I've been very interested in the relationship between journalism and fake news, and mm-hmm. also kind of the relationship between fake news and debates around the future of journalism. So since our book came out, some of the research I've done is studying both how fake news has been portrayed by journalists, but also I've done qualitative interviews with journalists in Denmark, as well as other media actors in debates around fake news, such as social media representatives and government officials, and talking to them about like the relationship between fake news and the future of journalism. So it's something I've really kind of dive deeper into in recent years, and so this work I'm mentioning now has not come out yet, but it's two different articles are in the pipelines. And I think journalism, first off, is key to explaining why fake news and post-truth really exploded into popular discourse, and because it kind of filled a convenient gap for journalists. And has done so in the past years. So journalism is in a crisis. Not just in one country, but across the world, crisis not of attention, because a lot of people read the news, but a crisis of economics, right? The traditional business models, which were centered around advertising, of newspapers especially, have just been, declining, and not even just declining, kind of demising, right? Because Google and Facebook and so forth, they are taking all this ad revenue. Journalists have a sense of crisis in their profession, right? How is journalism going to survive financially going forward? And what happened then with this notion of fake news, and it kind of condensed a lot of existing fears of journalists, right? It condensed the fear of social media, of technology, of people no longer trusting gatekeepers such as journalism. So that was also why they kind of, journalists latched onto this sense that the real problem is fake news, right? Because obviously the reality is much more complex. Like, because journalism has really suffered financially in the past years, we've also seen established media outlets really go into some shady practices, right? Of like native advertisements, presenting ads as if they are news articles, where people can't really tell the difference. And I've done a study of how a tabloid in Denmark allowed people to create their own letters to the editor online that looked identical to news articles. So they were shared on social media as if they were news. So, I mean, we do see a lot of manipulation coming from traditional media as well, right? Because they have to seek out these new and sometimes shady revenue models. But of course, journalism is core to the functioning of a democratic society. I mean, I think I can recommend Victor Picard's book, the American media professor. He wrote a book called Democracy Without Journalism about the death of local news in the US, right? How there are these vast news deserts in the US, and how this is really detrimental to democracy. I think having like functioning local news, independent news, of course, is really key. But again, I don't think fake news is the key problem to journalism, right? It is about core financial structures. Like, how is journalism going to make money? And of course, in the US, there is not a willingness to look into public service journalism, right? And this is kind of the argument Victor Picard is raising, that there needs to be a serious debate around allocating public funding for journalism. And I know Christian Fuchs, the Marxist media professor in the UK, he has also talked about like an obvious solution, right? Which is moving money from social media companies, all that ad revenue. That maybe there should be a tax on that, and moving some of that money to independent journalism, right? So I think the solutions are there in a sense. It's about it's about political economy. It's about moving money from these huge tech giants, for example, and towards independent journalism. But again, this whole fake news post-truth debate is often obscuring, I would say, obscuring these more boring but also more important conversations about taxing stuff and how to strengthen public service journalism, for example. But I think having independent and very critical journalism is key, right, to a functioning democracy, a form of journalism that is independent from both political and corporate actors, and can also really scrutinize these power holders in society. And I think we see that also in terms of disinformation, that the countries that have the most well-functioning media ecosystems and the strongest public service journalism have also fared better during cases of widespread disinformation. For example, now during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Right,
So, for example, in Scandinavia, in Sweden, in Denmark, these countries have fared well also in terms of disinformation compared to other countries. And I think journalism is key there. Public service journalism is key there. But again, I don't think disinformation is often like a derived effect from something much more fundamental,
which is
political participation, people feeling they are part of democracy and that they can influence politics of a functioning media system and these kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was going to ask you something else, but this that you just said reminded me of, you know, the recent happenings here in Sweden where there were some, let's say, rumors spread in certain communities about the social services in Sweden kind of taking children away from parents belonging to certain communities and so on. And I saw that Socialstyrelsen here, the social welfare board, you know, they looked at it from a classical information deficit point of view, that we need to inform these people better. We need to counter this disinformation better. And I was just saying to my wife, who works at Socialstyrelsen, that, you know, information is quite important here, but it is probably pointing out to a deeper cause. And that is the lack of trust and the lack of participation and maybe the feeling of any real capacity to influence what goes on. So it's really the other way around, where there is this fertile ground for rumors or disinformation to take hold, because that trust is lacking. So I thought of it when you said, I made your point now.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, I think again, and often, and that is also something we saw during COVID, in some cases, it's also marginalized groups that have a very, very difficult and troubled history with the government, for example, and with medical authorities, that have, you could say, a kind of logical reason to be distrustful of health authorities, for example, coming to vaccinate them more. I mean, so again, we need to look at like deeper structural causes of this kind of mistrust. And again, often there are historical reasons for these things, right? That need to be addressed in terms of participation, in terms of having, again, being part of the community you live in, and being part of kind of the political life where you live.
I would agree entirely with it. But just to pursue the topic of journalism, and I agree with you that the financial situation is a clear player here. Traditional journalism, at least, is struggling and almost like a demise, as you said. But others have also talked about, you know, a deficit of trust and a crisis of trust regarding journalism. Do you think that's a factor too, that the public has sort of lost faith in traditional journalism?
Yeah, I mean, there is a decline of trust in several countries, and not just in, I mean, in journalism, but also in political authorities. Again, what is interesting, if we look at these declines, there is no rapid or sudden development in recent years. Like it's more of a long, steady decline of trust. So again, we can't just say this is where social media came or this is where fake news exploded and then trust just plummeted, right? It is it is a much more structural long decline. So that's kind of one thing. But yeah, there is definitely a crisis of trust, we could say, which has been developing for decades in several countries, the US very notably, right? I think again, the in terms of journalism, the increasing distance between citizens and journalism. I mean, just physically, like the distance to your nearest journalist, like that distance has been increasing a lot, right? It's in a country like the US, it is extreme, like that from having multiple newspapers in quite small cities and towns in the US to suddenly not having any local news in huge areas, like that development, I would say kind of logically sparks less trust, because if you've never met a journalist or you don't or you don't feel that they ever cover your area, then slowly but steadily you kind of lose the sense that journalists know what's going on, right? And that is kind of what journalism is all about, right? As a reader, you should have a feeling that these journalists surely know what are the news, what is going on in the world. But if you can't see your life world, your situation reflected in the news, then that becomes very hard. I think that's also often the case in politics, right? When politicians talk about the economy going really well, and then people looking outside the window and seeing like all the shops closing down, like that discrepancy is just fostering a lot of mistrust. Like, how can this person be saying things are going well with the economy when we are clearly not part of that economy? Or what economy are you talking about, right? I think, again, it comes down to distance between lawmakers and citizens, distance between journalists and citizens, and the sense of feeling included in a political debate, in a media debate, and that distance is a real problem, especially in the US. And I think, again, we can look at Scandinavian countries and see that at least there, I mean, that distance has not reduced in the same way. There is also a decline of local journalism, but because Sweden and Denmark are so much smaller, all journalism is local journalism, in a sense, right? Like there are still, and there is, because there is public service journalism and financial support for newspapers, there can be a lot more variety. And again, this is why I think the US, for example, needs to be having a serious conversation about public service journalism. And as I said, like scholars like Victor Picard are trying to raise that, but it's not really, there's no political will for that at the moment.
No, that's very interesting. I'll definitely look up his work too, and I'll put up a link to it also later on the website. And there's so much about journalism that we could talk, and maybe I'll come back to that later. But just so that we get through some of the other questions too, you know, you began by talking a little bit about social media, and so I thought maybe I would come back to it. And you've discussed, and you even mentioned now, how social media, which were once lauded for their democratizing potential, they are now invoked as one of the, or even the most important facilitators of our entry into a post-truth era. And we've all heard about filter bubbles and echo chambers, and the title of my podcast plays on this notion also, between the bubbles. And it seems intuitive to assume that there's something about these technologies that encourages or it facilitates the formation of bubbles or echo chambers. But I've often felt that there's, you know, not really any empirical evidence being offered for this. It's quite speculative. And so I was digging around a bit and came across this Royal Society kind of synthesis or review. And they suggested that these might be, you know, less widespread than people usually consider them to be and that the picture is at best mixed in terms of polarization. I was just wondering, because you've looked a lot at social media, what you thought about this? What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. I think filter bubbles and echo chambers, they are really strong examples of the power of metaphors, right? The
yep.
power of this kind of popular sciencey concept that can really influence a lot of things. And I think so in that way it is similar and related to fake news and post-truth. And they've also I mean, they've often been coupled, right? People saying we live in a post-truth era because of filter bubbles, for example. But as you say, like, empirical evidence is not very clear on filter bubbles. And a lot of empirical evidence we have actually points in different directions. So the first thing we need to ask if we talk about filter bubbles is, what do we mean, right? Because that is often very unclear. But if what we mean is that people are surrounded in a network only of other like-minded individuals and only see political messages and news that they agree with, then that is not happening on social media. I mean, that is quite clear, actually, that, I mean, people who use social media are more likely to encounter arguments they disagree with, political arguments they disagree with, than people who don't use social media, some studies have indicated, which kind of makes sense when we think about it, right? We probably all know someone in our network who shared some kind of conspiracy theory during COVID or some kind of racist tirade or something, right? I mean, and that we would not be exposed to that on a similar basis. And some are actually arguing that this might be, if social media is driving polarization, which is very unclear, then it might actually be not due to filter bubble, but due to the opposite. That because we more often encounter arguments that we really disagree with a lot, we are more inclined to double down on our own position. We become more firm in our own political stance because we are continuously exposed to conflict on social media and these kind of vicious debates that can take place on social media. Of course, this is also still hypothetical. Like we are still very early in terms of social media research and really understanding the role of social media. But as a media scholar, I think that my first reaction to these kind of claims of filter bubbles, all the complete opposite, that social media is driving polarization, would be to say, hey, wait a minute, we need to be very careful not to just think of media as something that has some kind of direct hypodermic needle effect, right? Like mass media, there was the exact same talk about mass media, like radio is going to do this to people, or the television is going to do this to people. And of course, television played a key role and still does in people's lives. And obviously that has changed society in some ways, but it's not like a one-to-one effect. Then came television, and then we became more or less democratic or more or less polarized. And the same view should be applied to social media. But we don't find clear evidence of filter bubbles, at least not if we understand it in this sense of people being isolated. That is only a minority of social media users that experience that. And I can recommend Axel Bruns, who is a professor at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. He did a small book called Are Filter Bubbles Real? Which is really good and critically addresses this this issue and concept.
Fantastic. Definitely would like to look that up then. But I've thought it was really interesting that you said that if at all the effect might be the opposite, that because we are exposed to so many different opinions and information, different types of information that might actually make us be more entrenched in our own positions and lead to a bit of polarization. So it just goes to show that there is a lot of work to be done. And as you said, we are quite early still. I mean, social media haven't been around for that much more than a decade even. So, but this is a bit like the post-truth discussion itself, you know, where it felt to me, and I've said this in previous episodes too, that it felt like something that could at best be considered as a hypothesis to be tested, you know, a concept that's come up, and then we need to really look at it, examine it. Instead of taking that approach, people sort of just assume that, yes, we are now in the post-truth era, and then they try to find all sorts of justifications or rationalizations for saying so. And what surprised me was the number of academics, because journalists, you know, I guess I could, for some reason, excuse many of them, you know, on taking these sorts of narratives or going down those pathways. But there were many, many academics who almost seemed to, you know, jump on the opportunity. So there were people who published books on post-truth within, you know, a few months of the term emerging. And I'm talking about academics. So that really bothered me, how little critical analysis of the concept happened in the first couple of years. And I mean, I have come across very few sort of instances in the last, you know, couple of decades where, you know, even if you talk about things like the Iraq War or something, there was substantial opposition to it, even though that opposition ultimately didn't you know, manage to change the course of history. But with post-truth, it seemed as if there were, you know, 10 people in the world who were being critical and the rest were all on the bandwagon.
Yeah, I think I agree. Or like, I was also, I guess my own motivation to critically analyze the term and its implications also came from a frustration, right? How much it was uncritically adopted. And I guess it shows, of course, also that research is also increasingly moving fast, and people want jump on the latest terms and be part of the hot new debate, right? Yeah. And then only later we find out how things actually are connected. And yeah, I think we saw that again with now the infodemic concept during COVID-19.
Yeah.
So it has kind of continued, where also a lot of researchers just adopted this term, saying, oh, and now we're in an infodemic. And only very few, I mean, researchers stopped and said, wait, what is this term? And what are the implications of saying that we are facing an infodemic? Yeah. So it is happening, and it keeps happening in a sense. And I would definitely urge my colleagues, and I do this often, right, to be very careful about these kind of hot concepts that suddenly pop up, because it might seem like they're just, I mean, I think one defense of using concept like infodemic or post-truth is that it shouldn't be taken like too literal, or it's right. more like it's the word of the day to capture some kind of problem, right? With post-truth, the general rise of social media disinformation, and with infodemic, it was specifically about COVID-19 misinformation or disinformation, right? But I think we need to remember that these terms do much more than describe a situation. This is also something we really argued in our book, that these metaphors and these discourses, they shape not only how we understand a problem, but also how we try to solve it.
Yes.
And for example, again, talking about an infodemic, which is just as bad or like spreading just as much as the virus or even more, it really legitimizes taking very harsh measures, right?
Yes.
Because
yes.
just as we need to lock down for a period or have mask mandates to protect people from the virus, we also need to lock up journalists I mean, that's an extreme example, but what we saw during COVID is that many countries implemented these emergency COVID bills, which enabled governments to target journalists. I mean, that suddenly it became illegal to write misinformation or like fake news about how the government is handling COVID-19, which human rights groups, of course, pointed out would be very easy to abuse, right? To lock up journalists who are critical of the government's handling of the situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I agree with you entirely. And I mean, this may be a bit off topic too, but I can still bring it up anyway, because at least in the US context and maybe in parts of Europe too, it seemed also, and this is something Catherine Brown, whom I interviewed, has pointed out, that, you know, the post-truth notion and this narrative gave kind of liberals comfort, you know, to think of themselves as being on the right side and this enlightened group of people. And then they could sort of slam the other side for being unenlightened and susceptible to various forms of misinformation and so on. And again, I have myself, you know, I'm not sure if I call myself a liberal, just given the fact that I've lived half of my life in India, and, you know, even these sorts of labels are very difficult to apply to people there. But certainly my life in the West has been led more as a liberal individual. But I have always tried to be sort of a bit on the outside and cast a critical eye towards liberals and academics and, you know, so-called enlightened people themselves. But it has been very difficult to get this point across that, you know, while you assign blame to the other side, you know, it's also important to look at yourselves and the ways in which you might be contributing or even doing some of the same things that you accuse the other side of doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such an important point, and I really agree. And again, if we go back to 2016, I think it is very peculiar and interesting that "Make America Great Again" was the slogan for the American right, and solving post-truth became kind of a rallying cry for liberals in the U.S. and beyond. So. In both cases, it seemed that the zeitgeist of that year, we could say, of that period, was this dream of a mythical past, or like going restoring some kind of greatness, right? And I think that is, I don't think a lot of people who have used the post-truth term saw it that way, right? But exactly. I think that there are similarities, right? We need to be critical, I think, always of anyone claiming that we should go back to some mythical past, right? Yep. I think one of the greatest critics of that notion in relation to post-truth was an article by Robert Mejia and colleagues talking about the racial history of post-truth and how it's problematic, especially in the US, to say that we are now in a post-truth era, considering the US history of segregation and disenfranchising black voters and so forth. So, and I think that's a very powerful argument. I mean, because it also shows the whiteness of the post-truth narrative, right? It is largely white liberal politicians and academics and journalists saying we need to go back to a time where we as a group had even more power than today. I mean, I think that is a critical take on the post-truth era and that concept, which really is important to bring forth, because there is definitely some truth to that criticism, and which is why I think we should be wary of the term. And again, the risk is, like we've seen, I think a lot of academics also don't like think it through, like again think about the implications for democracy by some of the suggestions that have come forth. We saw during COVID academics proposing that we look towards like China and Malaysia and Singapore to solve the infodemic, which I think is really a terrifying thing to argue. I mean, I think in that case it was some British academics. They also had to kind of retract that part or that argument. But I think again we've seen it. We saw during the whole post-truth debate, Neil deGrasse Tyson, for example, tweeted that we need to have a ministry of truth to combat disinformation. Like, we've really had a lot of bad takes, but I think these bad takes don't come from, they come from a place, right? They come as a direct consequence, again, of the way we talk about it, of the power of these metaphors. If we've described democracy as suffering from a crisis, and this crisis is directly caused by a demise of truth, then it becomes legitimate to say, yeah, we need just need to restore truth no matter what it takes. And I think, again, this is what has legitimized a lot of bad solutions. And we have seen that when Russia in 2019 implemented their anti-fake news law, the government in Russia argued that this was necessary because Russia was not just doing this. It was being done across the world, also in Europe. And when Malaysia implemented their anti-fake news law, they also legitimized it directly with reference to the German NetzDG law, which is targeting hate speech especially. But I mean, so all these things are connected, like one government imposing anti-fake news laws that target journalists. They legitimize that through these discourses, right? Through these metaphors. Yep. We have an infodemic, and therefore it is legitimate for us to do this.
Yep.
And I think that is the scary part of this post-truth development, that that we are actually seeing some countries using the post-truth narrative to make their countries less democratic, make it harder to be to for independent and critical voices to speak up and to investigate. And we also saw that with social media companies, they have made it harder and harder for scholars and journalists to actually investigate what is going on their platforms. So since 2016, it has become harder to study Facebook, for example. And so yeah, I think we should be very careful about these things and critical towards what they legitimize. And then we should, again, try to zoom out or step back and talk about these structural issues that are facing democracy around participation, about decline of independent journalism and local journalism and so forth, and then also the rise of these tech giants with immense power that is so far has so far remained quite unregulated. Now things are starting to change, but it is still kind of worrying that there hasn't been more debate about how to regulate social media. There has more been debate about how to remove bad content.
So with that, we end part one of this episode. It's been a really interesting discussion so far. I hope you've enjoyed it too. Part two of the episode is already uploaded, so I do hope that you can join me and Johan for that too. Bye for now, and see you soon.